Accession number 10167, reel 12.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, Reel 12. You were telling me how they re-established what you call pre-war standards and using the guards as an illustration, the guard duties as an illustration.
Insofar as it affected ourselves, we of course were now back with the signals as a platoon. And we were back to manning switchboards, which is what we tend to do in sort of static situations, keeping the communications going, but also doing signal training and so forth. The signals officer at this time was someone had been a platoon officer. It was a person that I didn't get along particularly well with, nor he with I, because I knew a bit about things that he had done. So I was somewhat unhappy with what was then looking to be a more or less permanent situation. It wasn't as free and easy as it had been, apart from the wartime battle disadvantages, but we were getting to the stupid military disadvantages of peacetime. Civilian, peacetime, wartime, discipline, and activities. So I tended to become somewhat dissatisfied with what was happening at that moment in time. And it just, round about July, I think it was, it just so happened that there was an advert came round. This was more or less back to the old sort of way things happened, that there were battalion orders came out and people read them. And then battalion orders, there was an order came from division that if people wanted to apply the Royal Army Service Corps clerk's course, they could do so. So I didn't like the state of affairs that existed at that moment in time with the new hierarchy, so I decided to apply. I thought it was the end of the war, I might have to think about what I would be doing after the war, and certainly wasn't going to be a signaller after the war. So I applied for this clerk's course, and not surprisingly, I think pretty well everybody who applied got to go on it. And it began with my leaving the battalion, not without a lot of unhappiness. I mean, I had a lot of good friends there, but when the time came, I wasn't all that keen to leave. And it seemed a good thing to do at that moment in time. And we came back through Italy again by various routes, by road and rail, going to transit camps. It took almost a week, I think.
Did it influence you at all? In July, you still might have been sent out, theoretically, to fight the Japanese. Was
yes,
that
yes, that was part of it as well, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was always the feeling in the back of our minds that the war was still going on in Burma, and they could very well. I don't know whether they ever did or not, but it was our fear that they could do. So, yes, I thought that the further back I got and out of harm's way, the safer I might be in case of that. Yes, you're right. It was my undoing at Rome, I think, which caused a certain change in history later on. We went in the form of a draft from place to place. That's how they worked it. You sort of went in section by section. You'd go to a transit camp. We went to Mestre, and from Mestre I had a half day in Venice. And that was really great. I quite enjoyed Venice. And then we went by train, I think, from Udine or somewhere a bit further south than that, perhaps. But anyway, what happened, to cut a long story short, was that at Rome we were waiting for a train to take us on down to Naples, I think. And I was in this draft with all my kids standing on one platform. And I noticed on another platform was our colonel commanding the DLIs was just standing waiting for a train. So, I mean, just out of sheer bravado, I should not have bothered in the event. But out of sheer bravado, just to show what you could do, I was showing off as much as anything. I went up to him, gave him a formal salute and everything, stood to attention, and introduced myself, and he knew me, because we had met when he used to come around and see companies, he knew I was a signal.
Do you remember his name?
Colonel Worrell, yeah. And he'd taken over from Johnny Preston, actually. He wasn't an unremarkable. I don't think he was military or tactically a very good colonel. But, you know, he'd been adequate, I guess. He was all right. He's quite a pleasant enough person, anyway. So I could chat to him, and I chatted to him, and he was on had been on a course and was going back up the battalion again, and he asked me what I was doing, and I said I was on a course to go up there. And I thought that was the end of that. I thought, well, you know, very pleasant. I'd just shown what you can do to the rest of the draft. And I continued on my way. And we finished up at Caserta. There's a lovely palace at Caserta, which had been the headquarters, I think, of some of the generals in Italy at odd times. But anyway, the course was supposed to be there, but whether it ever was a course, I don't know. What they did was they just sent people off to do various jobs, various clerical jobs. And I finished up with the 8th Command Pay Office, which was at Caserta.
And that's part of the Royal Army Service Corps?
No, that's part of the Pay Corps. It's a different group altogether. But it was a clerical job. I think they were just sort of picking up clerks. I guess what had happened to them was that people were being demobbed. They would probably have long-serving people in there, and they were being short like everyone else was. So they'd applied for someone to fill in vacancies. The whole point about this was that they were at Caserta, and that was the furthest north that they had come, or the closest to the battle they had come. Before that, they'd been in North Africa. And I found this quite incredible. I mean, you never think about this until it's brought to your notice, that these were people who had been in war and had never been in any slightest danger whatsoever. And I suppose a lot of people were like that. This was Caserta, which was the whole of Italy away from any sign of battle, and before that, North Africa. And I thought, this is great. I'm going to stay with these people. This looks like a very good job. And it really was quite a stupid little job. Some people there, no doubt, did some decent clerical work. But I was put into the post room. And there were other people in the post room who had been there all the time. And you collected the post and you distributed it. That was basically what you did. And in your spare time, I had a job. The army had decided, or the pay corps had decided, that they were going to economize. So they sent lots of envelopes backwards and forwards with wartime soldiers' information on, and they used to send them back with these economy labels on envelopes, just reuse envelopes. So someone had the bright idea, we'd cut economy labels into half and use them twice over. So that's what we did in our spare time, cutting economy labels into half. And I thought, what a marvellous job this is. It wasn't furthering my clerical career very much, but I thought, what a great job it was. And the beauty of it was, became even more interesting, was that within about, I think, a week, they had moved from Caserta up to Rome. And they were in these houses in Rome. It's in a suburb in Rome. Its name eludes me. Anyway, it was a tram ride from the centre of Rome. And can you imagine, Rome had anything that anybody wanted for enjoying one's life. I mean, it was the centre of most of the facilities for the soldiers and the rest of the military forces in Rome. And we continued the same. We used to live in these houses. The food was good. The work was not remarkable. I went for the mail into Rome, came back, distributed it, cut economy labels into half. I did the odd guard duty, I did the odd night duty, and in the evenings and at weekends we used to go into Rome and enjoyed all the activities in Rome.
These activities, well, did the army provide activities for all these troops with not much to do, or as well as the sort of obvious activities?
Well, they had sort of canteens that they'd set up. Still, you know, the stage door canteen thing. They had one in Rome, in one of the old palaces, as I remember. And it was glorious, you know. Food was laid on there. They ran all sorts of shows. I saw Gigli there in one of these Fawcett shows. And then all of the nightclubs had Fawcett shows, you know, English and all of the Italian Neapolitan songs, of course, Sorrento and all of those. It was a period of time when Italian Neapolitan songs were top of the hit parade. So all of that was going on. It was as far as a level of...
What about the black market? Did you see much of that?
It existed, but it didn't have a lot to do with us, really. I mean, we didn't need the black market particularly, except for... The usual thing was getting your laundry done. I mean, we always used that. You never paid for getting your laundry done. Usually flogged soap or cigarettes or whatever.
But you didn't use the black market excessively to... I mean, I was thinking of you selling things rather than buying.
Yeah. Not at this point in time, no. So, all in all, it was very pleasant, you know, although I'd been very unhappy about leaving the battalion and my friends behind. I had made some new friends where I were, but it was the sheer pleasure of the new sort of life that was most exhilarating. And all of a sudden it came to a stop. I was called in to see the CO of this command pay office, and he said, well, you know, I'm very sorry, but they've asked for you back, because I hadn't been transferred. That was one of the trouble. You had to wait a while before you could apply to be transferred to them, and I was still a DNI attached to them, and of course my own unit could call me back at any time. And he said, your CO has asked for you to go back. And I said, well, bloody hell, I'm enjoying myself here, you know, what about it? He said, I'm sorry, I can't do anything about it. You're really still on his payroll, and if he wants you back, then jolly well ask for you back. So I was very disgruntled at that, and went all the way backwards up again slowly back to join them. And they were almost where I had been. But what had happened was that at this stage, all of those people with long service were being demobbed. And this is what was happening. It was a perpetual demob situation. It went by service and seniority. Drafts went out. And... they'd lost some people in their orderly room, which was the sort of clerical headquarters of the battalion. And, of course, the colonel had remembered this Elliot gone off wandering off doing a clerical job and come back here and do a clerical job. So I came back and said I was very disgruntled and I wanted an interview with him. And he saw me, I remember, and swore blind he hadn't asked for me back, although I knew damn well he had, and said that, you know, I couldn't go back in the signals. That's the other thing he said. I couldn't go back in the signals. He said, try in the orderly room. So I went in the orderly room, and, you know, I eventually was fairly satisfied with that. It was a fairly easy going, and there wasn't really anywhere near as much bullshit in those situations, because you were doing just a clerical job, truth be told.
What sort of job was it at that time?
Primary was this draft business. You know, you'd get notification that you had to send a couple of dozen people on a list, and you'd have to make all the arrangements for them from where you were by a movement order back in England. And there used to be lots of problems about people dropping out and being sick, so, you know, it was quite a busy operation, actually, and in the end I quite enjoyed it.
More challenging in the sense.
Yes, oh yes, yes.
Now, how long had you been away? You'd left in round about July.
Yeah.
And when did you come back?
Let me see. About September, I think.
So you'd been away 2 months.
2 months, yes. Yes.
And where exactly were the battalion?
Were they were in a place called Wilden in Austria, W-I-L-D-U-N. But the next interesting part was that, I made a bit of fuss, I think, first of all. And I think the colonel felt a bit unhappy that he had played a dirty trick on me when I told him how well I was doing down there. So they'd set up a leave camp in Venice, and they didn't have an awful lot of people that wanted to go because, you know, people were quite happy where they were. So I said, oh, I would go to Venice for a while because I quite enjoyed Venice, what I'd seen of it, and I have enjoyed it ever since. So I did go down on a forces leave to this rest camp in Venice. That was really something again. They'd taken over what is one of the main hotels on the Venice Lido, which is still there now, and it had been taken over as a forces leave camp, and for the first time, you know, slept in proper rooms and had glorious food, and Venice itself, which is really a beautiful place. So I had a week there, and that more or less compensated. I thought, oh yes, after that I'll go back quite happily.
It sounds still as if it was not very regimental in the pre-war regular sense, a colonel taking an interest in a private, so to speak.
I think I was probably Lance Corporal by that time.
Sorry.
I used to go up and down, I didn't used to last very long. I think it was just that I wasn't just an ordinary one. He knew me. I mean, he hadn't met me a lot, and I'd been around a while, and he'd seen me in action, and he knew who I was. We did talk as people would. And I think what had happened was that he'd lost his second in command in the orderly room. And it was a perfectly legitimate thing from his point of view. I was still attached to him, so he just called me back. And then when I came back and complained rather bitterly, he sort of made it up by letting me have this week in Venice. So I came back quite happily then to the orderly room.
What had caused these ups and downs in rank to the exalted heights of Lance Corporal and back down to private?
It had to do usually with sort of coming backwards and forwards back into the signal platoon. In the signal platoon, in a static situation, they couldn't afford to have lots of Lance Corporals because they only had about two or three, I think, who did specific jobs in a static. But if you were out representing the signals to a company headquarters, it wasn't considered unfair that one of those should be in charge because he had the responsibility for communications and that he ought to be a Lance Corporal.
So it wasn't.
So quite often, if you had seniority, they would make you a Lance Corporal while you were out. When you came back in, say, I think it was when I was in Greece, I got dropped again because, you know, there just wasn't a job for me to do. And then when we came back into Austria again, I got made up again.
Were you paid for during the times you were, or was it acting unpaid?
No, I was tending to be paid when I did it. Later on, it was acting unpaid. I think I was paid at that time. But I disremember the number of times. I mean, I used to be taking them off and putting them back on again. It wasn't very critical to me. But it was... I think I was probably sort of acting corporal in the orderly room when it came to the crunch. But the next really interesting part was round about October, beginning of October, there were these zones in Austria occupied by the main forces, the French and the Russian and the Americans and ourselves. And they all had to provide a guard for the main ceremonial duties in Vienna on a monthly basis. So we, the 16th DLI, were chosen to do this guard duty for a month in October going on to November. So we all moved up to Vienna, and I mean, you know, that again was very well worth going to. And although I was in the order room there, it was still very pleasant.
Now, those are quite interesting times, as I say, but, you know, the relationships between the Allied powers.
Yeah.
Was there any sign of it at ground level, of the different conflicting interests between the powers, or would you not notice any of
where
that?
Well, we were very well aware, you see, we were very well within. We weren't on the borders with any other occupying forces where we were. But when you went up to Venice, then you were conscious, and you were up close. At Vienna, sorry. Yeah, when we went to Vienna, they were occupying various sectors. So you, and although you moved around between the sectors, you were conscious of the fact that there were other people in those sectors. The Russians were always very suspicious and gloomy, and felt that they were still very aggressive and combatant, truthfully. They didn't trust us. The Americans are, as they all usually are, very full of bonhomie and very affluent and keen to throw their money around, show how clever they are. And the French are a bit cold and calculated and careful. But it was only the Russians, I think, that there would have been any difficulties with.
And what about the Austrians in the middle? How were they behaving?
The interesting aspect of this was that when we arrived at Vienna, we were in what was an old hospital. It was a disused hospital, and that was our barracks. And the Austrians used to ring in because they still thought it was a hospital. So we used to chat up, you know, various girls that way, and just to take them out, and we used to take one or two out. We started off by ringing the place up. Or you could meet them outside. That was how we sort of picked people up. But the Austrians were very pleased to see the British, the Americans and the French. They weren't very happy in the German zone, of course. But we got on very well with them. And looking at it now, it was an odd mixture. There was a seediness there. There was all this bombing that had gone on, so there was a lot of actual rubble around. But it was seedy because there was the black market about. And if you've seen The Third Man, that is exactly what it was like. It was an odd mixture of gaiety, the old joie de vivre was coming back again. And it was mixed with this seediness of, they were short of money, and the occupying troops did have the wherewithal. So there was a lot of bartering going on, and all sorts of black marketing activities. They were starting up again all of the opera and the music of Vienna. So all of the spectacle was returning, and we went, first saw Die Fledermaus there in Vienna, done by the Austrians, and one or two Austrian musical concerts. Glorious. And it's something, I think, to see the Austrians doing their own thing particularly well. But for them to be doing it again immediately after the war was particularly remarked. And, as I say, it went along also with all sorts of criminal activities, nefarious activities. We never spent any money in Vienna. We didn't do it ourselves. We had our rations of cigarettes and chocolate and soap and things like that, and we used to give them to an intermediary. There was one of the blokes who was the Mr. Fix-It.
Who would that be? What sort of person was he?
He, now, remember his face. Now, what did he do?
God. Was he a member of the regiment?
Oh, yes, yes. He was, yes. He was one of the lads. He had a job that gave him contact, somehow. He wasn't in the regimental police, no, I don't think. He was an orderly. He used to do messages in a sort of a war situation, I guess. He was headquarters orderly and got out and did things. I mean, he did things for the company. He would go out and take messages or go and collect things from civilian shops or what have you. So, I mean, he was in a glorious position to be able to... And he could get you anything he wanted. And, as I say, we never paid for anything. We could just use our normal rations and that would suffice for him to get tickets. So.
So you didn't actually have a contact with the black market, it was all at second hand?
Yes, no, we didn't want to get too bothered with the black market. I mean, you could very likely finish up in trouble. You got contact with the black market. We were quite happy to have someone else to do it for us. I mean, we didn't want to get involved with it. No, kept it at arm's length. Didn't want to know too much about it. I mean, it was very immoral, I think. We all felt it was immoral. That's why we didn't want our own hands to be sort of blackened with it. We were quite happy to blacken somebody else's hand. And he got a cut out of it. You know, I mean, obviously, he did quite well. But women as well, I guess. But I mean, most people sort of went out and got their own. You could take them out to the pictures and dances. And they were in Vienna and all sorts of forces clubs where they provided. And the pictures went full blast. So it was good to the pictures and what have you. I remember there was one trip we did. Les Brown, who was a mate of mine, he was on the signal side and he was on the switchboard. And this woman rang up and thought it was a hospital and got chatting to her. And he brought me on because I could speak better German than he could. Or marginally better term than he could. And we fixed up, after a while, we fixed up that we would meet these two. So we fixed them up and went to the pictures. After the pictures, we had something to eat. And really, I hadn't got anything out of it much that stage in time. And they wanted to go home, so, I'll take you home. And they lived in the Russian zone, which was a tram ride away. And we said, well, all right, we'll take her in the tram, because we never pay for anything, you know, just sort of go. And they weren't very happy about that. We thought, they just want a meal. They're not going to give anything back in return sort of thing. So we got on this tram, and whilst the middle of Venice, it was getting on towards late evening by then, the middle of Venice, of course, was lit and bright and so forth. The suburbs were dark and black. There wasn't really a lot of electricity, I guess. And the far-flung parts weren't very well lit up. And we went on this tram, not many people in it, and it went off in a direction towards the Russian zone at the speed of light. And the brightness that there was along this route was that about every mile or so, there would be a Russian outpost where there'd be troops and things, and that'd be lit up with flags and everything. And we'd go past that and go further on. And they got more and more agitated as we went, and we became more and more disconcerted because we seemed to be going further and further into the Russian zone as far as we could tell. After we'd been on this tram for about 10 minutes, it stopped eventually, and they said, this is where they live, which was the end of the line, as it happened. So we got off. There again, there was a Russian outpost with Russian soldiers armed to the teeth standing around. So we said, we'll show you, we'll take you home sort of thing. Oh, they didn't like that either. Weren't very happy about that. So sort of stoutly, you know, we'll defend you, we'll take you home, because they were afraid of the Russians, so they said. They lived in these large blocks of flats that were obviously in the suburbs. So we went towards this block. And the girls were becoming very, very much afraid by that time. And we weren't all together very happy with the situation because it was utterly black and nothing else around. So we said, come on, you know, we'll see you home. And eventually they said, well, look, you know, we're afraid not just for the Russians, but there are Russian sympathizers around here. And if they see us with you, they'll not only take it out of you, they'll take it out of us as well, you know, because... So we thought that was a very good idea, that discretion being the better part of valour. We said cheerio to them and dashed back to the tram as fast as we go and caught it before it can return. But we were right in the middle of the Russian zone by that time, and we worked our way back again. But had we stayed, goodness knows what would have happened, because people did disappear in the Russian zone and not come back at that moment in time.
So. Troops.
Yeah. So that was a bit of excitement to us. But again, it was very, very interesting and very interesting.